see you're growing tired, so set the bad day by the bed and rest a while. Your eyes can close. You don't have to do a thing, but listen to me sing. I know you miss the world, the one you knew, the one where everything made sense, because you didn't know the truth. That's how it works, till the bottom drops out and you learn. We're all just hunters seeking solid ground.
I know you miss the world, the one you knew. Sarah Bareilles singing from her album, The Song Amidst the Chaos, that is all the music we'll be playing this morning, is from that album. Sarah Bareilles, wonderful. She is a wonderful singer, songwriter, performer. She had COVID-19, recovered. A listener suggested that we celebrate those that we have lost and those who have made it. So we do that with this music this morning. If you want to see the playlist, you can always go to our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Good morning, everyone. How are you? It has been quite a week, and we are very grateful that you are with us, and we thank you for being with us. It's very important that we all get together and have this moment together, and we have this opportunity to speak with each other and know that we're not alone, and that we often have the same thoughts, and if we don't, we can talk them out. And that's what we try to accomplish on the program every morning. We have a wonderful group to do it this morning. Let me introduce them. Before I do that, however, just a reminder that you can always join in. panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. I was taken to task yesterday by a listener who said that we love your letters, and then we often will disagree with a letter, or not often, but sometimes we disagree with a letter, or that we will say something, snippy. And that we don't show the letter writer respect. I don't recall doing that, but or any of us doing that. But I will say that we do love your letters. We love to hear from you, and they are to incite conversation. And hopefully that's all we're doing. And simple as that. We have enough sniping, so we'll try not to comment, but if you ask us a question, we're going to give you an honest answer, right, Alan? I mean, that's all.
I would say right, and some of the letters are offensive.
Yeah, there's that.
If they are offensive, I'm going to say they're offensive.
Yeah, there's
too,
that.
Too bad. You don't get a free pass if you write a letter and say you're all a bunch of creeps and you're all a bunch of commie lefties or whatever.
Right, but we don't need to. Be mean about it.
Go away. Yeah. No, I mean, look, we want the letters, but we have to be free to disagree with them, and we will. I will anyway.
Absolutely. Alan, good morning. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. Ray Graff got it bad. He got it wrong this morning.
Uh-oh. What did he do?
He said it was cloudy out there.
Oh, is it not cloudy where you are?
It's snowing in Great Barrington.
It was snowing in Greenwich, yes.
It is snowing. Yeah.
It's spitting and it's no fun. Yeah. But, well.
I did my walk, however. It was good.
Snowy damned. You did your walk?
No, I did my walk at 6, and so it was
fine. We are joined this morning by Judith Eng, senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Hey, Joe. I'm good. I'm so appreciative of this poignant new part of the roundtable opening, and grateful that you and Sarah LeDuc and others play the music.
Mike Bowen, also muchly responsible for this.
Thank you, Mike, of course. Virtual hug to Mike. I mean, it's just such a poignant and and important way to start the show. So thanks. And today with some good news.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Also, we have Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasitti on the program. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. Doing well. Good. I'd like to say that economists by nature are snippy and angry. So that's just part of the tribe.
Point taken. But I've never found you to be snippy or angry, but that's okay. Well, look who our special guest is today. I am thrilled to welcome a dear friend. I've told this story probably 3 zillion times, but I'm going to tell it one more time. 31 years ago, when Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature, came out, he was the very first guest on my very first talk show. And ever since then, we have had a wonderful friendship. He is the founder of the environmental organization 350.org. He was among the first to have warned of the dangers of global warming. He is the author of bestsellers such as The End of Nature, Earth, and Deep Economy. He is the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College, and he is a regular writer for The New Yorker, and we are thrilled to have Bill McKibben join us on the panel this morning. How are you, my friend?
Well, I'm terrific, Joe, and how good to hear your voice and Alan's and everybody's, Judy's, everybody's. This is a real pleasure to get to join in from the mountains up here in Vermont, and just wish everybody all good things.
You all doing up there? Is it just you and Sue in the mountains?
No, we're very lucky. I mean, as isolation goes, we've been about as lucky as it gets. Our daughter and soon-to-be son-in-law joined us a little more than a month ago from Boston.
Good.
And they're radio people, so they've been producing podcasts and things day and night. And so the house was really kind of buzzing, I got to say. And truthfully, you know, there's a certain amount of overlap between freelance writing and social isolation, so I feel more prepared than most for what we're dealing with, considering we feel very, very, very lucky.
It's a very, very good point. Well, good morning, all, and thank you very much for being with us. It really means a lot to us to have you all here together. Again, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Well, let's just kick it off, and we'll talk about this OPEC story, which OPEC and Russia are said to reach a deal to temporarily trim oil output. This is OPEC, of course, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, and other countries, including Russia, reached a tentative agreement on Thursday to temporarily cut large volumes of production, according to a person with knowledge of the matter. OPEC and the other oil-producing countries agreed to cut about 10 million barrels a day, or about 10% from normal production levels in May and June, said the person who spoke on the condition of anonymity, because the announcement has yet to be made public. Possible further trims could come from a meeting of the group of 20 nations on Friday, which, yes, is today. Also, we were talking about Bill McKibben and writing in the Annals of a Warming Planet and writing for New Yorker and NewYorker.com. Bill has an article that went up yesterday that says, "Will the coronavirus kill the oil industry?" And as a result of the virus, he asks, we may well have already seen the peak demand for petroleum on planet Earth. So, Bill, let us begin with you. What do you make of this OPEC deal?
So it's all part of this larger and fascinating story about what's going on with oil and fossil fuel in general. As you know, this is an industry that's been under pressure for two reasons for the last few years. One, their product causes the grave overhanging crisis of global warming that shadows the century. And two, people are figuring out how to deliver the same product, energy, in cleaner, better, cheaper ways. You know, the price of a solar panel or a wind turbine's dropped 90%. And now that you can run a car or whatever off electricity, the oil industry was already in big trouble. Then comes coronavirus and the just cratering of demand for this product. And all of a sudden, you know, oil stocks and things, which had already been in the tank, were plummeting, and the supply of oil, because no one wants it right now, is going through the roof. So the oil industry has been doing, and on top of this, the Saudis and the Russians picked the moment to have a price war and flooded the market with yet more oil. So it couldn't be a worse moment for the oil industry. They're doing a couple of things in response. One is using all the political juice that they have, which is the thing they mostly have after a century of being the richest industry on the planet, trying to carve out special bailouts and tax breaks and so on. And we can talk about all of those. There's some really shameful things going on. Don't let me miss talking about the Keystone Pipeline right now.
Right.
And the other thing that they're doing, and here's, you know, where Judy's work is so important right now, they're trying to figure out some kind of strategy going forward. And the one that they've sort of at least half hit on is, since natural gas is the feedstock for plastic, put up more and more plastic plants and somehow try to get rid of the fossil fuel that we won't need in our cars and heating systems, and use it to make plastic bags instead, which comes obviously with its own set of enormous troubles.
Judith.
Yeah, well, I think Bill laid it out beautifully. I think we've got two paths ahead of us. One is COVID-19 shows us the importance of following and respecting science. So that would suggest a massive shift to renewable energy and all the other crucial components in the Green New Deal. The other path is propping up exploitive fossil fuel companies and projects like Keystone Pipeline. We know that fossil fuel is a dying industry, but their lobbyists in Washington are working overtime to make sure that they are bailed out, and not just with cold cash in future stimulus bills, but also, for instance, as we've talked about on the show, EPA has drastically relaxed rules for polluters exploiting the coronavirus situation. I still find this astonishing. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced a few weeks ago that during the coronavirus, they will not enforce federal environmental laws unless there's, quote, an imminent threat, which is a very, very high bar. Mm-hmm. The head of the EPA, Andrew Wheeler, is a former coal industry lobbyist, and his defense was, well, this doesn't count for criminal violations. Well, that's a relief. But most of EPA's work is civil, not criminal. So this is a real moment for all of us as residents of the world, not just the United States. Or is Washington and other countries going to prop up a dying fossil fuel industry? Or will we finally embrace the lessons of both COVID-19 and climate change, which William Kunstler, the writer from Saratoga, called the long emergency?
Right.
I think I got that reference right. So, you know, we're at the fork of the road. Which way are we going to go?
James Howard, and Kunstler, not William, but go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
He was the attorney.
Yes, yeah. That's all right.
Joe, the human fact checker in real time. Joe, we need you at the White House press briefings.
No, you don't.
That's how AMC Allen should broadcast to the daily coronavirus task force briefings, is the president says something and then Joe's gentle voice comes in. That's patently false. So here's my, you know, joyful spin on it. We can go either way, and I don't know which way we're going to go.
Well, and you talk about this, Bill, that really the key question is, if we can make a transition, how fast can we do it? You mentioned the juice that the oil industry still has. So activism remains crucial. Do you see, I mean, you're at the forefront of it. Are you optimistic that it can lead in that direction?
Well, look, for the moment, a certain kind of activism is off the
right.
Off limits. which in certain ways is sad. Barring coronavirus, we would have had demonstrations in the lobbies of half the Chase Bank branches in America, a couple of thousand banks on Earth Day, because they've been the biggest funder of the fossil fuel industry, and there's a lot of emerging analysis and understanding. However, we can work in other ways, and there's a real opportunity on this oil front in Albany right now. As of yesterday, I think, a majority of New York State senators had come together behind a bill that would demand divestment of the state's pension funds from the fossil fuel industry. Judith's husband, Mark Dunley, has worked on this, I think, really hard over the years, and so have a lot of other people. And the fact that it's now, Alan, I think what they call a super bill in the legislature is really, really interesting. This happens because Tom DiNapoli, the state controller, has just steadfastly refused entreaties from activists for a decade now to divest the pension fund's holdings in fossil fuel, and that steadfast refusal has been sad on two fronts. One, it's helped prop up the fossil fuel industry all those years, but two, it's also cost New York State a huge amount of money. These stocks have been a drug on the market for a decade now, precisely because this industry faces such unprecedented challenges. And the last analysis I saw indicated that had DiNapoli sold those stocks when activists first requested, that the state would have about $17,000 more per pensioner than holding on to them has resulted in. That's pretty big amount of money. And of course, now you wouldn't want to force them to sell at the absolute bottom of the market. That's why this legislation that I think Liz Krueger may be the sort of real force behind says that I think that they should take 5 years to get out of these positions. But the signal that it would send would come immediately. So it's really actually a powerful moment for Albany. We've watched as DiNapoli's twin in New York City, the comptroller of New York City, Scott Stringer, has begun divesting all the city's holdings, and that's going well. Indeed, around the world, this has become probably the biggest campaign of its kind in history. We're at $12 trillion now in endowments and portfolios that have divested. The University of California system with its $80 billion, endowment and pension fund, or, you know, just, I mean, I could list them all day, the entire country of Ireland.
I need to take a quick break. So let's pause there, and I'll get the rest of your sentence, and then we'll go to Alan and Aaron, and we'll do all of that when we come back after this short break.
Leaving all the windows open. We don't even mind the rain. Where we let the floors get wet. So what if the hardwood stains? 'Cause we're collecting evidence of one remarkable storm. How wild it was to find it, finally feel the climate, instead of only staying dry and warm. Rain on us, Saint Honesty.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and Bill McKibben. Bill, I cut you off. Anything else you wanted to say as we were talking about divestment?
No, I rattled on way too long.
No, that was fine.
To say that Albany gets to play a big role in this particular part of this drama right now.
Alan, anything you want to say about DiNapoli or any other issue that we were
well,
discussing?
I have great respect for these two, and Judith and Bill. For me to say anything about this in their presence is just silliness. These are two of the greatest experts. I'm sorry.
Not true, Alan. Your voice is so important on this because you're like me. You're a former state employee, so pension fund is going toward propping up fossil fuel. And there are a lot of state employees, past and current, who listen to the show, and they should know that Exxon value dropped 50% just in the last year. So that means our state pension fund lost $500 million. And I love our state comptroller, Tom DiNapoli. He used to chair the environmental committee in this assembly. I just am completely puzzled as to why he is stubbornly refusing to do this. So that's
I was actually going to get to that. I have asked him about Judith, for whatever it's worth. I've asked him about that because I, too, am concerned about it. A number of times. I love the guy also. I'm confused by this. Also, he has given a number of different answers in terms of where they're going and how he's getting to that end. Nevertheless, if I told you I remembered what he said, I'd be a liar.
we can probably find the tape at some point.
It's there's a reason you're not recalling it, because it's kind of nonsensical. But I think Senator Liz Krueger's bill in the Senate, and there's an assembly similar bills, Assemblymember Ortiz, whenever the legislature gets back to functioning, they've got to take up this divestment bill, because the longer it waits, the more money we lose and the more the planet is heated up. I just want to add, on the topic of when the New York State Legislature gets back to functioning again, yesterday I had the privilege of testifying before a Vermont state legislative environmental committee. Unfortunately, they're considering suspending recycling in Vermont, and we hope the Vermont state legislature saves the day on both suspending recycling and composting because of COVID-19. What was so interesting is the Vermont legislature, admittedly much smaller than the New York legislature, but they're in session full time, 6 months out of the year, really smart legislators. I'm so impressed with many of them. They are functioning. Their committees meet twice a week by Zoom. They have committee meetings, they're holding public hearings. And I know New York City is so hard hit, and all energy and resources have to stay focused on getting New York City and Long Island and other parts of the state through this pandemic. But at some point this year, the state legislature needs to come back and start functioning and dealing with things like not only pandemic crisis and budget crisis, but this divestment bill.
Yeah, let me just ask you a question, Judith, because, as I say, you and Bill are the experts on this. Obviously, Liz Krueger, who we have on all the time on WAMC and on the Capital Connections, you probably know, and is a great person. The question is, where's the rest of them? Let's say they're not meeting right now, but they've been around for a long time. This divestment idea has been around for a long time. Where is everybody, and why? What are they telling you as to why they're not doing it? And Bill, I'd love your answer too. In other words, where are the rest of them?
Well, a couple things. The Senate now has 32 sponsors, as Bill mentioned, a supermajority. Assemblymember Ortiz is working equally hard in the assembly. I think what is happening, and this is just speculation, is they are deferring to Tom DiNapoli. He is a very well-respected former assembly member. DiNapoli has set up this endless study process. And I think they're deferring to him, and they're not understanding the urgency of the issue. What do you think, Bill?
Yeah, I confess, I don't even in the many, many years when I lived in New York State in the Adirondacks, I didn't completely understand New York politics. And Alan, you've always been my my lifeline to trying to understand it. But my sense is that DiNapoli got locked in early on with the idea that he was going to engage with the fossil fuel companies and persuade them to change their ways. And this turned out to be whimsical. You know, the Exxons of the world know how to do one thing, that is dig stuff up and burn it. They still have 97-98% of their budget devoted to that, and just the tiniest bit to, you know, renewable things and whatever. And their political influence continues to be baleful in every way. But I think he probably got a little locked in there. And you know, everybody else has other things to work on, you know, leave it to the controller or whatever. And then I also have some sense that, there may have been a certain amount of the governor at one point came out strongly for divestment, and I think that DiNapoli may have felt that his prerogatives were being encroached on from the governor's office. And so it got, you know what happens in politics. Sometimes things, sometimes we don't make decisions entirely on a rational basis, because if we did, there's no moral reason and no financial reason to have ridden the fossil fuel industry right down the slide here to what would we say, to the bottom of the barrel.
Right. Let us remember that Aaron Pacitti is a guest on this program. We reintroduce and welcome him back into the conversation. But Aaron, I'm hoping you could address the economics of this, of how this ultimately impacts. Because while all this is going on, yes, we see our economy in dire shape.
Yeah, so even though I said I'm snippy and angry, I always defer to the experts when necessary. So I want to address one thing about just the economic and public response to what's happening. It's important to understand that the decline in oil prices is not a good thing. The fall in oil prices, which is just over 50% from late January, is an effect of the decline in global output and global demand. With, you know, half of humanity under a lockdown, the demand for fuel, for, you know, consumers traveling, for, you know, airline travel, for, you know, UPS and FedEx deliveries, all of that falls. So a lot of people think that falling oil and gas prices are good. They're not, because when oil prices go down, usually you see employment go down, growth go down, incomes go down. So that's a response to the economic fallout. It's not a positive thing. So economists don't like to see falling gas and oil prices. So with that said, the current crisis presents, and this is kind of circling back to what Judith and Bill mentioned, is that this crisis presents a pretty unique opportunity where you see a huge demand shock because of the decline in consumption, but also a really serious supply shock with Saudi Arabia and Russia going at it. That this could result in some type of catastrophe that could lead to a non-market driven outcome. And whether energy companies take a massive hit or not, movement to renewable energy, movement to something, you know, resembling the Green New Deal is going to be an inherently political process that could be nudged along by, you know, the economic conditions. But, you know, like Judith mentioned and Bill mentioned as well, just the massive amount of lobbying these companies are doing, the extremely entrenched vested interests, is not going to be broken by a, you know, fall in oil prices. It's going to have to come. There's going to have to be massive political muscle used to start the shift towards more renewable energy. And that presents an opportunity in terms of infrastructure investment, when we can think about alternative forms of infrastructure that don't exclusively rely on fossil fuels. So Milton Friedman, who was a very famous and very conservative economist once said, never waste a good crisis. And I think this economic crisis presents a number of opportunities, and I'm not going to get into all of the possibilities here, but one of which is rethinking our energy infrastructure.
Okay, Joe, if I may.
Yes.
Because Billen is doing such a great job, as is Judith, I do remember a little bit about, and they were the ones who said it, of what Tom DiNapoli said to me in some of these interviews when I've raised this issue with him. And I think it's been met with a certain amount of disdain by environmentalists, but I'd love to hear what they have to say, which is, we have such power that we can go to them and we can say, you know, oh, did I hear a sigh there?
I think Judith gasped. But yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, but that is, I just want to report, that is what I think I remember him saying.
Yeah, me. Alan, I think that's right. And
yes.
I think it just turned out to be objectively wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, he dramatically overestimated their ability to influence these giant companies, and nothing happened. So, you know, give them credit for trying in the first place. And so now is the time to learn from experience and push on. And DiNapoli is still at the point where he can have, you know, been a helpful force in all of this. And this is, you know, this sets the stage for precisely what Aaron was talking about. You know, we're in a crisis now. And it's a crisis that leads us to think differently about the world. As Judith said, one of the things that we get out of the coronavirus crisis, and it's not like there's a silver lining, but if we're going to go through this much trauma, we might as well learn something. You know, first thing we learn is that the physical world is real, and that you have to pay attention to it. You can't force biology to, you know, negotiate or compromise. It doesn't matter if you try to spin it, you know, it doesn't work any more than trying to do that with the physics and chemistry of climate change work. Second lesson we learn, and this is a powerful one, is that endless delay is our enemy. We look at what happened with the coronavirus. Countries like South Korea took it seriously. I mean, they had their first fatality the same day as the U.S. in January, and they took it seriously. And they flattened their curve, and it's not like their problem's over. In fact, there's, you know, new cases popping up and things. But they dealt with it a lot better than we did because we delayed, just as we did with climate change. We could have flattened the carbon curve 30 years ago with relatively modest and non-disruptive policies. A modest tax on carbon 30 years ago would have gotten us a long ways. Since we didn't, since we instead just put the, you know, gas pedal down, literally, we're now in a place where, A, we're going to have to take more disruptive steps, and B, we're going to suffer a lot of damage anyway. So because of that, it's important, A, to do all the things that we can now to, you know, like divestment that would really help, but B, it's also, as Aaron points out, a great opportunity to start thinking about how to use one crisis to try and preempt some of the other ones that are coming. To me, that means trying to use the current crisis to think hard about the two things that have spiked most dramatically on our planet in the last 30 years. One of them is the temperature, and the other is inequality. And there are ways to try and come out of this addressing those things. I look at both Germany and South Korea, who have predicated their economic revival post-coronavirus on some, you know, version of something that looks like a Green New Deal, because it's work we have to do anyway. And, you know, so far the Trump plan seems to be set up the pins in the bowling alley again, you know, which is not a very good plan.
Let me make a suggestion, Joe.
We have to take a break, but go ahead.
Yeah, Judith and I have both professed our admiration for Tom DiNapoli, and I have asked him, as I said many times, this very question. So the one thing I think would be great if we could get him on the program and let him answer some of this stuff, you know, particularly on a Friday when Judith is here or when Bill could join us, and it would be a fascinating discussion, don't you think? And fair.
Get him. Okay.
Get into that.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we have many letters, a couple on this very topic and many others on other topics. So we'll get to those and continue the conversation after this short break.
Door clicks while his wheels start spinning on the pavement. And I go fill the space up where he has been staying.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator Judith Enck, Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasitti, and Bill McKibben, founder of the environmental organization 350.org and bestselling author of The End of Nature, Deep Economy, many other books, and of course, distinguished scholar in environmental studies at Middlebury College. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I'm going to put these two letters together. Rob says, no offense, but fossil fuel divestment in the middle of this crisis is an absurd topic to cover. Love you, but this is ridiculous. Also, we go to Mario, who says the New York Retirement Fund is one of the best funded and most best managed pension funds in the country. Opening the fund's investment decisions to the political trade winds will jeopardize the financial security over 1 million current and future retirees.
Yeah, I'd like to check in on that, because another thing that is reoccurring to my addled mind is that as I remember, I did not know about Andrew Cuomo's views on this, but I do know that there was a putsch in which Cuomo was interested in assigning some of the duties of the comptroller to his financial guy. And during that time, and yes, I think that whoever said, I think Judith probably, that it was that he was, you know, upset about that. I think for good reason, because, you know, the controller is a constitutional officer whose duties are defined. So that, well, I'm not speaking specifically to the question of divestment, I am saying that there was a political war going on that had very little to do with divestment, I think, at the time.
But I'm interested, yes, and so that, and also for Bill and Judith, you know, the concern from the letter writers of well, why are you talking about this topic? It's ridiculous. And the other thing is, well, don't fix what isn't broken.
Well, I mean, don't, you know, it's not like the if I was a pulmonary specialist who is taking time out from intubating people to talk about climate change, that would be a good point. But since we're here talking, it seems smart to actually be trying to figure out what lessons we can draw from this crisis that will help us with crises that are coming at us that are in many ways already here. I mean, think about the year we've gone through. We've, because of the shock of what's going on with the pandemic, we've sort of put out of our minds that the year began with pretty much the most shocking natural disaster we've almost ever seen. I mean, the continent of Australia basically burned to the ground. 20% of their forests burned in the course of a couple of weeks. While we're talking, you know, in the last week, we've had the third great bleaching event in the last 5 years on the Great Barrier Reef, which is the biggest living structure on planet Earth. And it looks now like it's by far the biggest of these events, and huge parts of it wiped out. Mm. You know, we're dealing with our particular and horrible plague here right now. In sub-Saharan Africa, there's a plague of locusts at the moment that's so enormous that it's like nothing that they've probably ever seen there, and it's because rainfall patterns have changed so dramatically as the climate has warmed. I mean, yes, the coronavirus is the immediate, terrible, hideous challenge that we have to face and beat. But, you know, we were ahead of in our virtual Seder night before last, and when we got to listing the 10 plagues, it was like, you know, it's like you were teasing the news at 11, you know, locusts and pestilence agents and, you know, on and on and on. It's not as if we have the luxury of just pretending that there's only one problem on Earth. There are a lot. And if you can use the response to one to help deal with some of the others, why wouldn't you?
Mm. Bill, what is what has California done on this?
California's the most recent was that the UC system, which is enormous and has its own pension system, sold its entire, announced that not only were they planning to divest entirely from fossil fuel, they'd actually done it, their entire $80 billion pension and endowment fund. And when they did it, they said, look, we're doing this in part because people demanded it, but also because fossil fuels have simply become too high risk an investment for anyone to be engaged in. That doesn't mean, I mean, the writer who said DiNapoli's done a fine job of dealing with the pension fund overall, that may well be true, but that doesn't mean that this part of it wasn't a mistake, because it clearly was. So don't get, you know, fixated on it as the only thing we should be doing. It's just an easy thing that we could be doing. I mean, think about the changes that people have to make to deal with the pandemic that we're in or to deal with the climate crisis that's coming. On the list of things that need to happen, deciding that, you know, it's time to sell New York State's stock over the next 5 years, you know, yeah, it's not as easy as just business as usual, but it's really not very hard.
Let's go to some other letters that we have from listeners. This one from Duane, who says, I'm extremely concerned about the Trump administration replacing inspectors general with their own loyalists. Please discuss how this blatant corruption can be countered.
Well, there's one answer we always give. Judith always gives it. I'm giving it now, and that's November. There's an election. This is an outrageous betrayal of the American people. It's an outrageous betrayal of the Constitution, in my opinion, of the responsibility that a president, you know, has. And the Congress, you know, set this thing up. And this guy has, for his own insidious reasons, you know, fired the guy who was there to protect the American people. It's outrageous. We all know it's outrageous. I heard Chris Murphy on the television this morning talking about it. And it is something that we're going to see again and again and again and have seen again and again. The only thing they can do is Nancy Pelosi can insist on the next bailout bill that some language be put into the thing that prohibits that kind of thing from happening again. But he'll find a way around it. The guy is just beyond trouble.
Well, the consistent thing with the Trump administration is just when you think it can't get any worse, it does. And I mean, and just his behavior and the tone, even over the last week, you know, every 47 seconds an American dies due to the virus. 16 million people filed for unemployment benefits and recently. And yesterday, President Trump was actually tweeting about his television ratings. I think, you know, there have been press reports that some of his aides, who he probably doesn't listen to, are trying to tell him that every time he speaks at these coronavirus task force press briefings, the more he speaks, the worse it is for him. I go back and forth on, you know, and even personally. Yeah. Sometimes I you know, I vow I'm not going to watch it anymore. I just want to listen to Dr. Fauci, but he grabs the mic. But there was a CNN poll of registered voters released yesterday. And Biden at 53 and Trump at 42. So I guess we want Trump to keep talking but stop doing all the terrible things he's doing.
Well, that's a great point. That really is a great point, that this and I was about to mention that 10-11 point difference. And it makes sense to give some respect to the American people, particularly to the independents, who clearly are a big part of that shift.
It is just about 10 o'clock. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have Alan Chartok, Judith Henk, Aaron Pacitti, and Bill McKibben. We will go to your letters. We will talk about many other things, and we'll do all of that after this break and news with Ray Graff.
Tendy with the good hand stutters when she's speaking. Johnny drives a big rig, Johnny's not sleeping. Sweet Geraldine turned 80 in the spring. But her nerves won't quit, she worries about everything.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Henk, Aaron Pacitti, and Bill McKibben joining us this morning. More than 16 million Americans lost their jobs in the past 3 weeks. There is growing consensus among economists that the government's efforts were too small and came too late to prevent businesses from abandoning workers. The Federal Reserve said yesterday that it could pump $2.3 trillion into the economy using measures that go far beyond anything the central bank attempted during the 2008 financial crisis. Kathy Bosjancic is a chief U.S. financial economist at Oxford Economics, and she says it's as if the economy as a whole has fallen into some sudden black hole. What do you make of that, Aaron Pacitti?
She is the first economist who has actually said what I think every other economist is thinking. So I'm very appreciative that somebody has finally called this a black hole. I think last week I referred to it as the sky falling. Well, it's continuing to fall, and what we're seeing in its place is this black hole. So again, the important thing that I want to stress is every time I see and anybody else sees an economic forecast about what's going to happen, almost every forecast I've seen is grossly overly optimistic. So, for example, the forecast for the increase in initial claims for unemployment insurance, which is a good measure of new layoffs happening in the previous week, that forecast was 5 million and the total was 6.6 million. So it was about, you know, a third higher than what was forecasted. So what we're likely to see is probably an unemployment. So right now, if you factor in a bunch of variables that I won't bore people with. The unemployment rate today is probably around 16%, and there is no sign of that abating anytime soon. So I would not be surprised if the unemployment rate stabilizes around 20 to 25% over the summer. And, you know, with a longer term forecast, which is nothing more than an educated guess at this point, you're probably looking at around 10% unemployment come the end of 2021. So that not only is depression-era levels of unemployment, it's also a period of extended unemployment, probably in the double digits, that the U.S. economy has never seen. So because this is so unprecedented, economist models do not have any way of forecasting this. The only thing, and, you know, so a lot of people say that, you know, well, there's a, you know, a trade-off between the economic damage that's happening and the public health aspect. So when, you know, Trump and other politicians talk about, well, we need to reopen the economy as soon as possible, that can actually do more damage than good, because if, you know, we relax some of the public health measures like social distancing and opening non-essential businesses, this could cause a crash that's worse than the initial one, because people might get lulled into a false sense of confidence. And if there's a resurgence of the virus, then that confidence would disappear and we could fall into a hole that's even blacker than the one we're in now. The economic recovery entirely depends on the public health response, which is being able to treat people nationwide at levels that are not critical, increased testing, and the availability of a vaccine. All of those things are more or less, I don't know, they're on their own course. The one thing that's in policymakers' control, so to the extent that there's good news and that there are measures that can be put in place, is a very rapid and very extreme policy response. So you saw that with what the Federal Reserve announced yesterday, which is another $2.3 trillion in lending. And every week I say to myself, well, now I've seen it all. And every the following week I say, well, I was wrong last week. What the Federal Reserve's doing by lending to directly to private businesses that have less than 10,000 employees is unprecedented. Extending massive amounts of liquidity to, you know, municipal bond markets, large bond markets. It makes their response to the 2008 crisis look like kid stuff. So the Federal Reserve is doing exactly what it should be doing, and that is acting as a lender of last resort and providing a financial backstop and absorbing all of the risk that the private sector is either unwilling to or unable to absorb.
Now, what about Trump? Trump?
Okay. Yeah,
he
yeah.
said he sets up this alternative to the Pence Commission on Health. He's now is setting something up because clearly he has to open the economy or he loses the election, and he knows it. So how dangerous is this?
Well, I don't know if it's dangerous. I think what needs to happen, and, you know, if he's thinking in terms of his own self-interest in terms of getting reelected, I would think that that self-interest also corresponds with the public interest, and that is a level of absolutely. It's a level of federal spending that cushions the blow to households and businesses by providing direct financial assistance. That's exactly what the economy needs. Provides funding for hospitals and testing to get the public health aspect under control. So I'm not agreeing with that. I'm saying that, you know, to the extent that he's got an ability to get this under control, that works in his self-interest, reopening the economy is not the solution. And I think his advisors like Peter Navarro and Steve Mnuchin understand that, whether Trump does or not, and that they would be pushing for this. We would need probably an additional $4 trillion of federal spending to really fill in the black hole. You know, whether or not there's political support for that is anyone's guess. But what you're seeing is, you know, an extra $250 billion here, an extra $100 billion there, and that's just nibbling around the edges. I mean, you need a second round of federal spending that is – you know, an order of magnitude greater than the first round.
Mm.
And
can I ask a question?
What I meant was that.
Yeah.
Sure. Actually, let me finish this thought.
Sure.
What I said was that what's in Trump's interest is also in the public interest. I'm not arguing for, you know, my own political preferences. I would not like to see him reelected. But to the extent that he has any chance to garner public support, it would come in the form of cushioning the blow to households. So
I just want to ask a man in the street question. If you walked around Great Barrington two days before the crisis struck, you would see virtually every business saying, "We need employees," right? I mean, in other words, we know that we were at zero, whatever. What's going to happen, Aaron, in your very important opinion? What is going to happen as things begin to open up? Do we have a continuing unemployment crisis or what?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, part of me wants to bite my tongue and say, well, I just said every forecast economists are making has been wrong on the underside. You know, if the economy reopens, I think people have already changed their psychological and behavioral patterns so that even if the economy does reopen, you're going to see an extreme amount of caution in terms of spending because people are unsure about whether there's going to be a resurgence of the coronavirus.
Right.
People are going to be more hesitant to hop on an airplane. People are going to be more hesitant to stay in a hotel. And that's going to be the primary effect. But then you're going to see the ripple effects in terms of, like, well, what about the, you know, firm that manufactures sheets for the hotels? What about, you know, all of the downstream effects?
Well, many of those businesses, many of those businesses will be out of business, right? And they're not going to be able to make it through this.
Yeah, correct. I mean, I think most small businesses have a cash cushion on average of around 2 months. The size and the efficiency of the payroll protection program is, one, woefully inadequate, and it's getting hung up with, you know, administrative and technical glitches. That's wasting very precious time. So, yes, Joe, you're right. A lot of these small businesses won't be around, which further exacerbates the unemployment crisis. So I think what you're going to see is to answer Alan's question, a very long and very protracted unemployment crisis and an extreme amount of economic uncertainty, the likes of which we have not seen in modern times, that's probably going to last at least until the end of 2021.
You know, 10 years ago, Aaron, or maybe 15, maybe 20, my memory is, you know, of time is not that good, but we had the futurist on the air. And he made a prediction. He said in 10 years, nobody would ever go to a movie again. that certainly has not turned out to be, it certainly has not turned out to be true. He said that 20 years ago or whatever. So I'm not going into a movie theater for a long time. And I'm sure there are a lot of other people whose habits may be changed permanently as a result of this.
Absolutely.
Yep. If you talk to people who lived through the Great Depression, you notice an extreme amount of thrift. They finish all the food on their plate.
You are
those
so right.
Once they're ingrained, do not change very fast. I think all of this, an economic recovery will proceed and be sustained once a vaccine is developed that that eases people's psychological uncertainty.
We're going to go back to the letters. Harleen writes, because of all the damage we're doing to planet Earth, it is attempting to heal itself by killing us. There's a sobering thought for the morning. Will writes, curious on Bill McKibben's view on the election. He and many of us know Biden's climate plan is insufficient, objectively. So what's the electoral goal now? Bill.
Well, I mean, I think that obviously the political landscape keeps changing, and now Bernie is out of the race. The goal, obviously, to me, it couldn't be clearer, it's to elect someone who isn't Trump. And it's not that Biden's going to solve the climate crisis or anything else. It's that then you'd have someone in power who you could pressure and work with, and politics, you know, would be a real thing instead of now when we just have someone. I mean, it doesn't make the slightest difference what anyone tries to do or say or talk about or work on or pressure. I mean, the comparisons with, you know, Obama. When Obama was elected, it's not like he went straight to work on climate change. Some of us, though I'd supported him, I organized what turned out to be some of maybe the biggest single demonstrations in during the Obama era outside the White House, and they were around this Keystone Pipeline thing, and because we had someone there who you could at least talk to and pressure, we won the fight, you know, and it was a really important fight because it led to people going after all parts of big oil and so on and so forth. That's what we could do with a Biden in office, and we wouldn't have a crazed, narcissist man-child who clearly is way, way, way over his head in every possible way. I mean, in the larger sense, to go to what Aaron was talking about, the thing that makes this scarier in one sense than the Great Depression is the sense that there's nothing, nobody in Washington who's stepping up to deal with it. If you tried to think of two people who were more different from each other, Donald Trump and FDR would probably be at the top of the list. So I think think everyone, I mean, I assume that most people, even most of my fellow Bernie supporters, will quickly figure out that elections aren't a test between good and evil. They're a test between whoever two names are on the ballot that have a realistic chance of winning, and you pick the one that's better than the other, and then you go to work. You know, politics doesn't end on Election Day. Election Day is just the start of it, and, you know, Judith knows that as well as anybody else. You know, she and I have been, you know, Joe, as long as you and I have been talking with each other, Judith and I have been working on one political project after another. She was a great hero and leader of environmental fights in the New York State long before she went off to Washington went off to work at the EPA. So politics, that fight has to continue, but it can't continue. It hasn't continued these last 4 years because we've been in this sort of insane period with a completely impossible human being whose every impulse is about himself, not about anything to do with the larger good.
Judith? I loved. Can I just say one thing? I loved what you said just now, Bill. Of course, my question is, because you come from the Bernie camp, and the question to you is, I keep hearing from people who are writing me letters. They're telling me I'm going to never vote for Biden. Come the revolution, you know, that's what we're looking for. Come the revolution, we'll start all over again. What do you say to them?
Well, I mean, there's probably some of that, you know, and I hope that it can be tamped down. You know, I worked really hard for Bernie, particularly last time around. You know, he named me one of the five people to go off and write the platform on his behalf in the Democratic Party. I introduced him the day he ran, he announced for office. You know, it was me and Ben and Jerry introduced him on the shore of Lake Champlain. And I think he's done an enormous service to our political life. I think that ideas that people used to think were fringe ideas, we now understand are mainstream ideas. But I think that there's no cogent argument to be made for trying to make things worse so that they'll get better. Things are plenty bad enough, and the damage that will happen, I mean, look, if we're going to face things like coronavirus or like the climate crisis, and we are, we're going to face an increasing and difficult series of emergencies, we simply can't do them in this society as riven and torn apart as ours is. We desperately need some kind of social solidarity. And so, you know, one hopes that we can figure out how to do that in the political process. But clearly, job one is to get rid of Trump. Because I spend a lot of time with students and young people. And one of the things that's hard is remembering that they have a kind of N of one with presidents, maybe two, but, you know, young people, one, like Donald Trump is their idea of what a president is. And you have to keep explaining, no, he's not only just not a good president, he's utterly different from anything that we've ever had before. You know, there have been plenty of people who have been president who I've fundamentally disagreed with and really didn't like and whatever. But there's never been a president that I wouldn't have, you know, left my daughter with for 20 minutes while I went to the store to buy milk, you know. I mean, we're in completely uncharted territory. And we almost, you know, we almost got through 4 years of it without, you know, the most kind of hideous damage. But then came this coronavirus, and man, did it demonstrate every single weakness of having a, you know, a narcissist buffoon running the country.
Judith.
Well, I've been very impressed with the way Bernie Sanders has handled his exit from the race. He could have hung on a little bit longer. The numbers weren't clearly working for him, but he got out at the right time for the good of the country. And just in the last 24 hours, Biden announced that he'll now support changing the age by which you're eligible for Medicaid from 65 to 60. Of course, I would like it to be Medicaid for all, but, you know, it's going in the right direction. Yesterday, he also announced some limited loan forgiveness for student debt for low-income people. And I'm reminded of FDR's quote, "I know what to do, now go make me do it." And, yes, you know, what Bill shared is absolutely spot on. With Biden, you can have a reasoned conversation, and all the levers of democracy that we've used over the past many decades can be utilized again. You know, the thing that greatly concerned me when Trump won the election, although I'll always say he didn't win the popular vote, is all the democracy tools that we used kind of went out the window with him, because the only thing he cares about is himself and Fox News. But I am now, let me announce, an enthusiastic supporter of Joe Biden. I will work very hard to get him elected, because if we want a future for not just our kids and our grandkids, but also ourselves, the single most important thing that we all need to be focused on, including learning online activism, learning to love Zoom meetings that go on forever and ever, we need to adapt our skills and get Biden elected.
Let's go to Brian's letter, who said, "I'd love to hear the panel's thoughts on the impact of factory farming in both climate change and our current pandemic." Who wants in on that? Bill? Judith?
Judith may have smarter things to say than I do, but it's clear that our agricultural system it plays a role in all kinds of the problems that we face. We've built a very, very corporate and concentrated agricultural system. And so when there are problems, they ripple out very quickly. Some of the things are very unique to particular parts of the world. The coronavirus emerges from Asia because there's this tradition, which hopefully now finally people will put an end to, of live markets and wet markets and so on. The climate crisis is intimately connected with agriculture in that we need solutions that can come in part from changes in the way that we treat soil, in the way that we allow farms to serve several purposes, instead of just being corporate farms that have put farmers out of business and put rural communities on edge, all in the name of ever cheaper food. Ever cheaper food may not turn out to be quite the bargain that we thought. And one of the interesting things, and, you know, I was thinking hard about what Aaron was saying about changes in our economy. All those changes, you know, people not getting on airplanes or whatever, come with a flip side to them, too. The airline business is clearly in trouble, and I would think probably maybe in a kind of terminal trouble. But we're learning how to do things other ways. And I saw the other day that the value of the company behind Zoom is larger now than the combined value of most of the airlines. As with food, clearly some things are changing. Among other things, Americans are learning to cook again over these weeks because we don't have access to the fast food that was providing so many of the calories that Americans consumed. So some of these changes are going to be really rippling and deep across our psyches and hence across our economies.
We're going to pause there. We have to take a break. When we come back, we will have our last round together with this wonderful panel. Alan Chartok, Aaron Pasitti, Judith Enk, and Bill McKibben. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. It's panel at WAMC.org. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to as many as we can. Maybe we'll try for a lightning round when we come back. We'll do that right after this short break.
Smiles in the morning at me, apartment on the second story, strangers in a brand new city, both remembering last night, kitchen table and a bottle of wine.
Just a reminder, we're playing the music of Sarah Bareilles this morning, who had COVID-19. She has recovered. Her album is Amidst the Chaos, which we are playing this morning. You can see the entire playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. As I mentioned, we have a lot of letters. I'm going to try to get through as many as possible. So panelists, please, if you can, just keep it short and sweet in your answers, and we'll go through as many as we can. First up is one for Aaron. I hope I'm wrong, but I'm afraid that Trump will get a lot of credit and a lot of votes from recipients of $1,200 checks and small businesses. Do you think these measures passed by Congress will win the November election for Trump? Well,
absolutely not. There you go. They're
okay.
Too short-lived.
Alan?
The election's in November.
No. I agree with Aaron. I think what's happened is, you know, the Congress will claim that they did it, and the $1,200 will disappear very, very quickly. It will not begin to do what needs to be done to save so many of these people. So, no, I don't think so.
A comment from Susan, who says, while Joe Biden isn't the best candidate, I believe he will at least be open to advice and opinions of his cabinet and other experts. With Trump, it's his way or no way. Nick says, our current situation didn't just start with Trump. The Senate has been a desolate land of do-nothing for years under Mitch the Snitch. Dixie says, same as a previous letter writer, Biden will surround himself with competent people who know how to get things done. Steve says, as a former employee of Exxon Daystar in Woburn, Massachusetts, back during the Carter administration, at the high point of oil prices, I am puzzled why these well-funded fossil fuel companies don't get back into the alternative energy game. Bill McKibben.
Say that again, Joe. I missed a little bit of that.
As a former employee of Exxon Daystar in Woburn, Massachusetts, back during the Carter administration at the high point of oil prices, I am puzzled why these well-funded fossil fuel companies don't get back into the alternative energy game.
That one I can explain.
Okay.
Look, you can make money in renewable energy, and people are, and people will. But you can't make the kind of money that Exxon was making in its heyday, and for a obvious reason. Once the solar panel is up on the roof, then the energy comes for free every morning when the sun comes up. And from Exxon's point of view, that's the stupidest business model of all time. They've made their business by making you write a check every month forever to get another delivery. And so that's why they've not only not gotten into the business, that's why they've fought with everything they have to make sure that no one else can get into the business either. Look, the reason that we're in the biggest difference and the thing that to me makes me hopeful about the pandemic that we're dealing with is precisely the fact that there's not a trillion-dollar industry whose interest is in promoting coronavirus. But there was a trillion-dollar industry whose interest was in promoting climate change, and we now know from great investigative reporting over the last 4 or 5 years that that's just what they did, that the Exxons of the world knew everything there was to know about global warming back in the 1980s. They studied it to a fault. Their graphs predicted what the temperature would be and the CO2 concentration in 2020 with uncanny accuracy, and the executives believed them. Exxon started building every drill rig they built to compensate for the rise in sea level they knew was coming. But instead of telling us, they set up a massive, you know, the entire industry, a kind of massive architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation that kept us locked for 30 years in a completely phony debate about whether or not global warming was real. Thank God we got through that part of the coronavirus thing. It only took us a few weeks of, you know, silly denial. The cases will go to zero. A miracle will happen, you know, whatever, to get us past that part of this fight anyway.
We also have, while I have you here and we continue our lightning round, let's go to Jim's letter, who says, could the panel speak to the impact of a declining oil industry will have on people of the world who have no alternative industry, such as Iraq and Saudi Arabia?
Well, that's a very good question, and Judith and Aaron will have good answers, too. I'll just say it's going to be difficult for countries like Saudi Arabia, like Russia, and for parts of our country, Oklahoma, whatever, that have so bought in North Dakota, so bought into this industry. The good news is that 80% of the people in the world live in countries that export as that import as opposed to export oil. So for them, renewable energy is a way not only to provide cleaner cities and so on and so forth, it's a way to have way better balance of payments, be able to supply their own energy needs instead of writing a check to the, you know, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia every month. And so in that sense, probably the net of this transition is really good for most of the population of the planet.
Judith.
We usually get this question in the context of coal miners in West Virginia. And it, as the letter writer says, it applies to the world. And we need to get familiar with the phrase just transition. So as we transition to 100% renewable energy, which makes a whole lot of sense for New York, for instance, because we don't have oil and coal and thanks to Governor Cuomo, fracking from natural gas, but our indigenous energy resources are the sun, the water, the wind, heat pumps, geothermal, etc. So as we make this transition, we also need to focus on living wage jobs, universal health care, everything that is in the Green New Deal. And I think in addition to people reading everything that Bill McKibben is currently writing on these topics, spend this time, if you're home and you're not burdened with healthcare and health worries, spend this time at home reading Naomi Klein's book, The Case for a Green New Deal. And it really takes this issue of just transition on very, very effectively.
Amen to that. Naomi is as smart a mind as we have at work in this world right now. And if anyone ever doubted what she wrote in her book, The Shock Doctrine, a few years ago, you're seeing it play out around you right now.
Aaron, did you want to weigh in on that?
I think one thing, it's kind of extending what Bill and Judith both mentioned. I think what's going to happen over the next probably 20 to 50 years is a radical radical reorganization of the global political and economic order. So thinking about what happens in oil-dependent countries in the Middle East, I think is just going to be a small part of that puzzle. How fast countries respond, how effectively they handle political, social, and economic stability, I think is going to be crucial. So 10 years from now, we might see a very, very different world, for better or worse, and that depends on the policy choices, than what we have now.
Let me go to, Jonathan says, thank you for the wonderful speculation of ways to sue economic plans to fend off other crises. It meshes with the work my climate science class is currently doing. My students will be listening to this discussion in an upcoming assignment. All right. Hopefully they know you as Jonathan. Jim, this one's for Judith. Quickly, I was surprised 2 days ago to go into my local market and told that I could not, by direction of the CDC, use my reusable shopping bags. I missed this news. What's up?
Yeah, it's not by the direction of the CDC. It's just that some individual stores have decided that they don't want people to bring in reusable bags. There's no scientific evidence linking reusable bags to COVID-19. Particularly, I urge people to wash their reusable bags. And so once Trader Joe's, I don't know if it's company-wide or in some of their stores, they will allow you to bring your reusable bags as long as you pack your groceries yourself. So those are the conversations, you know, people can be having. I've been working on this for the past few weeks because the plastics industry is trying to exploit this crisis. And so far they're winning. I also want to say we need to not be so hard on ourselves during this crisis. We will get back to reusable bags. We will get back to Starbucks letting us bring reusable mugs in. I am concerned that there are delays on important environmental protection laws, but we just have to be vigilant and make sure that these are not permanent repeals of laws, just delays in enforcement.
Jude says, yesterday, according to the only tweet highlighted yesterday by Chris Cuomo, the vice president forbade Fauci and Birx to speak on CNN. But hooray, Fauci did speak on CNN this morning. They went back on that, yes. Can you believe the White House is so scared and threatened and manipulative that they have to take those steps to keep up their illusions? I guess, Alan, it was an issue of they didn't want CNN was going away from the president. They were only going to Fauci and Birx, and then they were saying, okay, well, then we're not going to give you them.
Well, you had better believe that Fauci is the man who will come out of this with a reputation like guys like many of us remember Peter Rodino and, you know, during the Nixon times. Fauci cannot be told what to do. He'll do it anyway, in my opinion, because they can't afford to do it. It would be cutting their 11% behind in the general election, throats even worse than they're doing. But the fact is that it was clearly the president on the phone with Pence telling Pence to forbid it.
So we have 3 or 4 minutes. Let me just ask you all as we wrap up. We have Passover, and of course, this is Good Friday and Easter on Sunday, and we're all home, and we are quarantined, and we are doing our best with social distancing. And I would just like to go around and just have your thoughts on how we can make this time even more meaningful by what we do. Judith, do you want to take a first crack?
Yeah, so we do need to look for silver linings. And for me, like Bill, I have my adult journalist son up from Brooklyn. He and his woman friend are living with us. We've discovered they are really good cooks, and we never want them to leave. So I think, valuing time with our family, I've got to reduce my consumption of the news. This is a terrible time to be a political junkie because I love following politics, but at the federal level, it is just so grim. And, this is a moment to think about what kind of world do we want in the future? How can we all be advocates for a clean earth? You know, we all have a role to play, whether you're a journalist or a writer or an average citizen or someone that has a pension invested in fossil fuel. So I just think, this is terrible. I'm not minimizing the tremendous pain and suffering on worldwide, the lost jobs, the deaths, the illness. But those of us who are so privileged, we have our one assignment, don't go out. This can be a time for reflection and renewal for us, especially at a spiritual time in our religious calendars.
We've got about 2 minutes. Bill McKibben.
Well, I think that the one thing that I hope kind of we may take from this is a reminder of how much we actually like each other. There's a way in which Americans have been engaging in social distancing for quite a while now, hiding behind an ever larger array of screens and spending more and more of our time, staring into things. And now now that we're in detention, you know, we're reminded of how much we miss each other and how much we miss coming together for things. I hope that when this ends, some of our, you know, we kind of really prioritize that gregariousness and fellow feeling, because I have a feeling that that's kind of key to dealing with a lot of the problems that we face in our society. So if there's going to be not a good outcome, but a change, a way to reflect, maybe that's it. We're socially evolved primates, and it's good to remember that.
Aaron?
I think now that people have the, well, people are forced to stay inside, the opportunity to count the very, very small things in life that they are thankful for on a daily basis. And with the hubbub of the 24-hour news cycle, overwork, those things tend to get lost. So it's an opportunity for people to acknowledge those and be thankful that they have them in their lives.
And Alan?
Let's all remember we're all in this together. WAMC is what I'm thankful for. You know, it's just been fabulous to see the kind of reaction that we are getting from folks and the thank yous that we're getting. I mean, I know that sounds vain, but so many people are writing and making a small contribution and saying, hey, this is my radio station, and I'm so glad you guys are here.
Well, I want to thank all of you so much for the beautiful conversation this morning. It was just terrific. Alan, Aaron, Bill, Judith, be well. Love you all, and I'll we'll talk soon.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.